Hi, everybody. My name is Lee, and I'm an alcoholic. And God has been real, real, real good to me. Let me say that right now. I appreciate Jim and his committee's efforts, and this is, in my opinion, has just been a tremendous conference. And I've been to a few, and everything went smooth on my end. I was very happy. And Scott for his letters and phone calls and his assistance here, and Mike getting me from the airport and getting me back to the airport. Go ahead and thank you, man. Hopefully. Well, we missed one exit on the way here, but he immediately turned that Toyota into an all-terrain vehicle. Another miracle. And didn't let that policeman there in the medium scare him at all. I want to thank Randy and Michelle for the use of their fishing pole. And I didn't catch anything, but I spent a nice hour and a half out on that dock yesterday. And I have, yesterday was, I guess, really Friday when I came in was my first day off work in over a month. It's been nonstop since the last week in July. And the way my work is you just get it when you can get it, you know. So it has been such a pleasure to be able to come here and rest and just relax and sit down and just really take it easy. And I've done a lot of that. And I can't think of a more beautiful place in the world for God to bring me to sit and just do that kind of thing. I don't want to forget anyone. I've really, Mike, I'll listen to your tape from the airport. Lorna and Wayne, thank you very much. Wayne does a step study, by the way. If you can get those tapes, you better get them. I've listened to them several times. It's out of the 12 and 12, and it's tremendous. Frenchie's 24 years. Debbie's good job as the voice. My sobriety date is November the 20th, 1984, and I'm a member of the Central Orlando group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Central has a character of its own. I'd like to give you an idea of that. I was down in Vero Beach recently, and the topic was the gifts of sobriety, and the first woman shared, and she said, serenity, you know, and talked about serenity and what it meant to her to have peace of mind and be able to relax and be calm. And next guy shared, and he said fulfillment, what it meant to him to work with others, and how the joy from within, you know, that he had as a result of service and things like that. And the next guy said integrity and what it meant to him to be able to handle responsibility and to do what he said he was going to do and follow through. I said, boy, what a great topic. When I get back to the Central group, I'll bring this topic up. So I was at the Central group. I said, we're going to talk about the gifts of sobriety. And the first little lady over here said, teeth. Guy over here said, early parole. One over here said, pants. And the guy next to him looked at him and said, dry pants. You would love the Central group. We meet on the corner of Highway 50 and Broadway in downtown Orlando. There's 31 meetings a week, and if you're ever in that area, please come. You'd certainly be welcome. We have a lot of old-timers. Central began in 1945 when a fellow by the name of Dave Andrews got a copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was at the end of his rope, so he was so desperate that he started doing the things the book said to do. It was given to him by a doctor. And as a result of doing that and immediately trying to help others, the guy stayed sober. And they started the first meetings in the old Lamar Hotel downtown. So we have a lot of old-timers at Central. You know, we love our old-timers. I was in a meeting not long ago, and brand new guy stood up and said, last week I was in a hot tub naked with five naked women. Old timer jumped up and said, you'll never have to go through anything like that again. I heard about an old timer took his wife to the doctor. Nothing really wrong at all. Took her to the doctor. Doctor examined her and said, there's nothing wrong with you at all. You just need sex. She said, well, you'll have to tell my husband. The doctor called the old-timer in and said, there's nothing wrong with your wife at all. She just needs sex probably three times a week. I suggest Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Old-timer thought for a second, and he looked up and said, well, I can get her here on Monday and Wednesday, but Friday she's going to have sex. I'm glad the old timer here this weekend has 28 years. I'm glad for all the new people here. I want to tell you something. I was sitting there just about to step up here, and the man with 3 days, walked by the door and gave me a little encouragement. You hear what I'm saying? The new man. You know, in Orlando, in Florida, when we do deals, we have the countdown, and we'll have the oldest member, the most sobriety, and the least sobriety come up, and they present a big book and stuff like that. And I was in a deal not long ago, and where the longest sobriety was about 50 years, and then there was a girl there that had about 2 days. And there were some long steps leading to the podium. And the person with 2 days was helping the man with 50 years get up those steps. You hear what I'm saying? Thank you, Larry. I'm rich with gratitude. This is God's story. And every day God does for me that what I could never do for myself. My earliest memories in life are laying in bed at night, unable to sleep, having imaginary conversations with kids at school, planning and practicing these conversations. And I would say, I'll say this to this person, and maybe if they say this back to me, then I'll be able to say this back to them. And hoping that when I went to school the next day that I would be able to fit in with others somehow. And there was always some guy at school that was just perfect in every way, that just everyone liked, always dressed neatly and seemed very well accepted by everyone. Usually had blonde hair. I just hate this guy's guts, and I was mean to him. And that's been my problem all my life. I had a problem a long time before I ever took a drink of alcohol. I was always tremendously obsessed with myself. And of course, I found a solution for that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in practicing our program, I can be relieved from this self-centeredness enough to be able to fit in with others and think of them and to be considerate of others. And what a liberty that is, to be free of that today. But I didn't have that then, and it was still a while before alcohol became my solution to that problem. When I was big, I was born big. They used to tease me and tell me you're born on the 18th, 19th, and 20th of June. And I played sports. I played basketball, football, ran track, played baseball. And I was pretty good at sports because I was big. And I lettered in football and lettered in track and basketball. And I did those things basically as an effort to try to fit in with others, trying to fit in with a group of people. And I never really felt that I did. I don't remember a time in my life that I didn't feel less than, inferior to, or fearful of everything and everybody around me. There was always some guy on the team that never dropped the ball, that always made a touchdown, that always got the girl, that everyone liked, that seemed very appropriately dressed neatly, usually had blonde hair. I just hate this guy's guts. And I just give him hell, you know. I never gave the guy a break. When I was about 15 years old, I grew up with my grandparents. I lived with my grandparents. My mother and dad had a lot of problems. I've lived long enough to make a lot of the same mistakes, and I understand that so much better today. But at that time, I lived with my grandparents. And the community we lived in was just south of Little Rock, and it was very small. But there was a girl in the neighborhood that I was just nuts about. And boy, I became really interested in girls. And I knew when she would be coming home. She was 2 years older than me. She was a cheerleader, and she was beautiful, had a car. And I would peep through the windows and watch, you know, until she came home, and I would see her drive up, and I'd say, oh boy, she's so beautiful. Oh, I love her so much. You know, one of these days I'm going to talk to her, and I'm going to tell her I love her and things. And, you know, we'd be at school, and I'd be talking to a buddy of mine at school, and we'd just be talking, and she would walk in the room, and she would just walk right over next to us and stand right next to me. And out of the corner of my eye, I could kind of see her arm, you know, her skin. I could see her hair, and I could kind of smell her, you know. My mind would start racing. I couldn't think. I couldn't breathe, and sweat would pop out all over me. I'd have to run out the door, you know. I couldn't stand to be near her, you know. She might know what I was thinking. After the ball games, we'd have a dance in the gym. And I would see her there, and I'd look at her, and there she would be, and I'd say, I'm going to ask her to dance, you know. And I'm going to talk to her, and I'm going to tell her I love her. And boy, we're going to walk outside, and we're going to go under the bleachers, you know. And it's going to be so great, you know. And that song would end, and I'd say, well, after the next song, I'll ask her to dance. And that song would end, and I'd say, well, maybe after the next one. And then some guy with blonde hair would go over there and ask her to dance. Screw the whole deal up for me. And, you know, that would have been my whole life, you know, except for one day, just a magnificent and wonderful thing happened. One day my grandparents were gone, and a buddy of mine came over to our home with two bottles of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. And I drank one bottle, and he drank the other. And in a matter of 10 minutes, I was standing out on the roof of my grandparents' house screaming out my declaration of love, you know, for this girl. All that fear was gone. I felt like I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof, omnipotent. And that's the way I always wanted to feel. Alcohol certainly did for me that what I could never do for myself. And I said, my grandfather came home, he pulled me off the roof and put me in bed. And when I woke up the next day, I found what I've been looking for. And I'll tell you, from that point on, I drank alcohol every opportunity I got. And I know I was very young, I was still in high school, but I was big for my age. And my buddies, we would pool our lunch money on the way to school. You could get a case of Boone's Farm for $7.20. And we'd take that and put it in the lockers and under the seat of the car and in the bushes and such. Another thing about my drinking is it never bothered me to drink first thing in the morning, you know. Why wait until evening to feel so good? Alcohol created for me an unreal world, and I drank to live in it. And I loved it, and I drank a lot. I thought it was a compliment. People would say, "Boy, you sure you drink a lot?" I'd say, "Oh, thank you." You know? I immediately started having a lot of trouble. And I would, you know, I'd lay out all night and not call my grandmother and things like that. And there were many times I'd sit with my grandmother and I'd say, "Never again, grandmother. It's those guys I'm hanging out with. It's their drinking what's getting me drunk." And I, you know, that's the end of that. You know, and of course I'd go out and do it again. We didn't have any money, and the guys I hung out with, they wanted to drink the way I wanted to drink, and we began to steal. The men in my family did not steal. The men in my family worked and took care of their loved ones. That was not my example, but we did. And when I first started stealing, it bothered me a lot. I felt really bad about it and stuff like that. And then later, we would steal, and I'd say, "Well, you got to steal. You know, we're going to drink. We're going to have to steal." But still later, we would steal, and I got to where I just loved it. And I wanted to steal something from everybody. So anyway, when I was 16 years old, I was in juvenile court. My grandfather found out about that. Oh, my God, we've got to help him now. When I was 17 years old, I was in civil court. My grandfather heard about that and said, "Oh, my God, what will the neighbors think?" When I was 18 years old, I would walk down that road where my grandparents live. My grandfather would see me, throw his hands up in the air, run inside and scream to my grandmother, "Oh, my God, he's coming back." You know, he would grab his tools and his guns and start locking those things up and hiding them. My grandmother would grab her purse and her jewelry, and by the time I would hit the door, she'd be clutching her purse to her like this. My grandfather would be standing with his arm over the portable television set. And that was the last place I would ever go. I only went there when I was just sick and hungry and tired and dirty. No place left to go, but I would go there because I knew my grandmother would feed me and wash my clothes and try to take care of me one more time. And I would talk to my grandmother and I'd say, "That's it." And the first day would be okay and the second day would be okay. And on that third day, I'd be pacing the floor back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Walk outside, walk around the house 10 times, come back in. My grandmother would say, "Are you hungry? Can I fix you a sandwich? Would you like something to eat?" I'd say, "Get off my back. You're bugging me. You're always watching me. You're smothering me. How do you ever expect me to have anything or go anywhere or do anything with my life with the way you treat me?" And I'd, boom, blow out the door. And I would have to go drink. And alcohol was the only answer that I had when that madness would overcome me. When I was 19 years old, I caught my first prison bit. I was not ready. I was real green. I thought I was pretty tough. I'd had a few fights in those alleys. But I was clueless. And for you that have been, I don't have to tell you. For you that haven't, take my word for it, you don't want to go. Prison is a very violent place. Every day was a day filled with screams, blood splattered up on the walls, and somebody running down the hall screaming with his throat cut. And I said, if I ever get out of this place, if I ever get out of here, I'm going to go to work. If I ever get out of here, I'm going to get a job. I'm going to be the man that my grandfather is, and I'm going to make everybody proud of me. And when I got out, my grandparents picked me up, and I remember driving down that old highway. And I could not have been more happy. I was free. I knew I would never have to have that experience again. I had survived. And I was looking down at the middle of the road, and I saw the stripes down the middle of the road. And I said, "What are those there for?" I know those stripes are there for some reason. I could not remember what the stripes down the middle of the road were for. And just one thing after another like that was happening. My second day out, I hooked up with a pint bottle of Jose Cuervo. 2 weeks later, I was with the same guys doing the same old things, and 2 months later, I was back in again. And you can take the next 12 years of my life and just stick them in the garbage can, because I was in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out. Every time I got out of jail, I thought I was free. Every time I got out, I said, "I'm never going back. I just want to be a regular guy. I just want to have a job, have a car, live somewhere, have some clothes. You know, maybe go to school, have a girlfriend, what it appeared to me that anybody in this world could have. But I would get out and I'd take a drink and I was back in before I knew it. And I was clueless. I had no idea. Alcohol was not a problem in my life. Alcohol helped. Alcohol would help me keep going. It would help me forget. It helped me stay together, pull together another day. I took a job on the river once. That's an answer. The no liquor stores on the river. 30 days on, 15 days off. I made it 28 days. I wanted to kill everybody on that boat. I'd go into my quarters. I'd sleep with a pipe. I'd say, if anybody comes in here, I'll kill you. I'll kill you. And I jumped the boat at 28 days and got just as drunk as I could get. 2 weeks later, I called those people back and just begged them for that job, and they would not do it. Somebody said, Lee, what you need to do is get married. You find you the right woman, and she'll settle you down. And believe it or not, I know this is hard to imagine. This is a real stretch. There are women who are actually looking for guys that don't have jobs or cars, drink a lot of alcohol, and sleep with pipes. And I found me one of them. She broke 13 pairs of glasses off my face the first 18 months we were married. She'd never heard of Al-Anon. She was more like an alligator. And I'd try to work. I'd get these jobs. I'd say, I'm going to go to work every day. I'm not going to miss a minute. And I'd go in and I'd fight it and I'd work all week long. And Friday, boom, now I can drink. My God, there's nothing like Friday drinking. And I'd drink Friday all day, Saturday, Sunday, and I'd come up with these plans like, I'm going to pass out at 5 o'clock on Sunday. Then I'll be able to get up and go to work on Monday mornings. And Monday mornings were hell. And I'd fight my way in there. And I'd make it until Wednesday. Okay, now I'm not going in that bar to get drunk. I'm just going to have a couple. I just want to unwind. I'd have one, two, three, and I'd never remember four. And I'd drag back in 2 or 3 days later. And she wouldn't understand this. I know one time I was speaking with her. I said, honey, I know I haven't been the best husband. But I want you to know one thing. I'll never abandon you. So she packed all her stuff and left. They said, go somewhere. Go somewhere else. I said, that's it. Happiness is Arkansas in the rearview mirror. I went to Michigan. I went to Oklahoma. I went to New York. I went to Texas. And I finally ended up in Florida. Yeah, first couple of times I moved, I said, it'll be better when I get to Michigan. The last couple of times I moved, I knew it wasn't going to be any better. I just had to get out of town. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in New York City. My wife had left. Most times when they leave, they go to the other side of town or move in with their mother. She went all the way to New York. She wasn't planning on coming back. But she called my mother, and I found out about it, and I got her number and just called her and begged her, baby, please, 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 please. You know, when she would leave, I'd say, good, go to hell, you know. But I'd have a little money and some gas in my car. But boy, 2 weeks later, I would really start missing her. And I called her, and baby, we can't throw away this love, you know, we got all this love. But she would listen to that stuff. And she said, if you come up here, you're going to have to do what I tell you to do. And I said, anything, boy. And boom, 23 hours later, I was in New York City. I jumped out of that car and ran in that apartment building. I grabbed her in my arms and hugged her and squeezed her and told her I loved her. I love you, I love you, I love you. We're going to be so happy. She said, Lee, if you stay here, you're going to have to go to AA. I said, you bitch. How are we ever going to make it with your attitude? That's how I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Basement of a church. I walked in. The guy standing up there speaking. I knew he was a liar the second I saw him because he had blonde hair. I wouldn't listen to that guy at all. But after the meeting, two men came over to me and tried to reach me. And they talked about their drinking. And they talked so openly that it encouraged me. And I talked a little bit about my drinking. And you know, all my life, all I'd ever heard from my family or anyone that ever knew me was, Lee, we don't understand, we don't understand, we don't understand, we don't understand. And I was talking with this guy, and he stopped me, and he looked at me and said, Lee, we understand. And I'd never heard anything like that before in my life, and it scared me when that guy said that. And I took a couple of steps back, and I just listened to this guy talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. He said that he was working, and that his family, they were together, and they were happy. And all these wonderful, 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 wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous. I told him that things had to get better for me because they just could not get any worse. But boy, I was wrong. And I did not know that alcoholism was a progressive illness and that it always gets worse. I wound up down in Florida. I was not there very long at all before I found out what the Florida correction system was like. The last 3 years of my drinking, I know it's only by the grace of God that I'm here at all. I cannot tell you how many times emergency vehicles came out. I have a hazy memory of blue lights and flashing red lights, somebody picking me up off the ground, my head being busted open, or police trying to straighten me out somehow. The last 3 years of my drinking, I tried everything I'd ever heard of or imagined to try to do something about my life. I went to a hospital once and just begged those people to take me in. I did not have a nickel's worth of insurance. But they took me anyway, and 3 days later I was kicking that nurse's desk and cussing her out, you better let me out of here right now. And I walked out and got just as drunk as I could get. My wife took me to a minister who counseled with us and prayed for us. We went to a big, huge crusade deal. We went 3 nights in a row. I sat in the back of the top balcony all 3 nights. But at the end of each one of those services, they would say, if anybody here needs any help, if you want God to help you, God wants to help you. If you'll come down here, there'll be someone pray with you, and we know that God can help you. And I would make that trek from the back of the top balcony each night, and I'd go down, I'd pray with anybody that would pray with me. I was not trying to fool anybody or con my wife. I really meant business. I was desperate. But I was drunk in a very short time anyway. Not a therapy for alcoholism. I went to a psychiatrist. I told her the truth. I told her about the violence in our home. I told her about all my drinking. I talked about my criminal activity. God, everybody knows you don't tell them that stuff. She said, it's going to be okay. Call me next week. We'll make another appointment. It's going to be fine. Come back. I walked out the door. I just heard clunk, that deadbolt. I probably scared that woman to death. She probably prayed more that hour than she had in a long, long time. My last really bad drunk, I came to on the living room floor. I pushed the television set through the window. There was glass all over the floor. My wife came back to get some more of her things. And when she came back, I was talking with her and trying to reason with her. And I was sick. But she had had it. And as she was walking out the door, she reached into her bag and pulled out a little piece of notebook paper and zinged it to me. And I unfolded the little piece of notebook paper, and someone had taken a pencil and written a prayer and given it to her. And for the next 2 weeks, I just sat in there and read that prayer over and over and over again. I did not know where to go, and I did not know where to turn. My grandparents, every thought they had, every move they made in life, was some effort to try to make me happy. And they could not make me happy. My wife, every thought she had, every move she made in life, was some effort to try to make me happy. And she could not make me happy. Every thought I had, every move I made in life, was in an effort to try to make myself happy. And I couldn't make me happy. And I concluded that happiness was not obtainable, that life meant nothing. It wasn't going anywhere, and what's the use anyway? I was captured and wound up in the Seminole County Jail. It was there that I was separated from alcohol. I was sick. I was real sick. Very often we come here to Alcoholics Anonymous, unwanted, unwelcome anywhere. I was not unwanted. I was wanted. I was wanted in Orange County, Seminole County, Volusia County, New York, Arkansas, Missouri. Were all very interested in me. I must have been a pretty interesting guy. Every day they'd take me out and rain me on charges. One of my sentencing judges leaned over the bench, said, I've just sentenced you to every year I can give you. I'd give you more if I could, and you are despicable. When I got back to my cell, I found a dictionary and looked that word up, despicable. It said, worthy of being despised. I said, I know that. I've known that all my life. That's nothing new to me. I didn't know anything at all about being through with alcohol, but I knew one thing. I was through with me. I'd had all of me I could stand. I couldn't stand another second of me. I'd think, why was I born? Why am I even here? Why do I exist? I'm not good for myself or another human being. I'm not close to another human being. No one wants to have anything to do with me. I heard there were meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous available there in the Seminole County Jail. And for nothing more than thinking maybe I could get a little court play out of a judge, I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. A guy named Jerry W. brought the meetings in week after week after week. And Jerry would bring a guy in with him, and he would get up and do what I'm doing today. He would tell his story. And I know a guy came in, and he was dressed sharp. I figured the guy was dressed sharp. He must be a businessman. The guy talked about his drinking and talked about a solution he found in Alcoholics Anonymous. Next week, a guy came in and said he was a plumber. He talked about being a plumber. And he talked about his drinking. He talked about a solution he found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just went week after week after week. I did not know if AA was for me or not, but I was certainly looking for something. They shipped me over to Orange County Jail to get some charges over there. Boy, I couldn't wait to get those. And while I was there, they had a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I went to that meeting. And I was there, and a black guy got up, and he spoke. And now this is a guy that had done time, serious time. Boy, he really got my attention. And he talked about his drinking, and he talked about a plan of recovery. He talked about the book Alcoholics Anonymous. He talked about being productive and having a job, being able to live his life free from the obsession to drink alcohol. And he had the book Alcoholics Anonymous with him. And as he spoke, he would just wave that book over his head like this. And I would look and I'd go, my God, that's a big book. That's the biggest book I've ever seen. They'll never get me to read that big book. You know? The next day they asked if anybody wanted to go to the library. And I was not a big library kind of guy. You know, we didn't hang around libraries. But I said, I'll go to the library for no more reason than just to get out of the cell. And I walked into the library there at the 33rd Street Jail in Orange County, Florida. And I walked in, and for no reason, I turned to the left. And I walked right up to the books. And right at the end of my nose was the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And hopelessness makes that a very exciting book. Alcoholism, losing, failing, and doing everything but dying makes the book Alcoholics Anonymous very exciting reading. And I took that book and I went back to my cell and I opened it up and I saw my life. It was absolutely, the lights just came on for me. I remember in the third chapter reading two paragraphs about a jaywalker, and I said, this is me, this is me, this is me, this is me, this is me. And as I was reading through the book, I came to page 63 and I found a prayer that I'd sat in a darkened apartment and read again and again and again for 2 weeks. When I saw that prayer, it seemed as though God himself was speaking to me. And I wanted it. And that was 15 years ago. I want to tell you this. I want it today. And I want it more today than I've ever wanted it before. And it's more important for me today to unite with you people and do the suggestions that are laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous than ever before. And when they shipped me back to the Seminole County Jail, I came back ready to do whatever it took to be one of you. And I got with Jerry that brought the meetings in. I said, Jerry, just please tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. Jerry said, Lee, I cannot tell you what to do, but I'll show you what I did. And he pointed me again to the book Alcoholics Anonymous and said we had a program. He didn't say, eat a candy bar, don't drive down the road with your favorite bars on, and don't hang around with people you used to hang around with. He said, we have a program. He said, Lee, I can't promise you a good job. Maybe one of these days you'll get a good job. Maybe you won't. Lee, I can't promise you a wonderful relationship. Maybe one of these days you'll have a wonderful relationship. Maybe you won't. Lee, what we can promise you, that if you would do the things laid out in this book, that you can have a relationship with a power greater than yourself that can make your life mighty wonderful. And I got to spend a little time with our new man, Larry, yesterday. And I would go to Jerry, and I'd say, Jerry, I'm a goner. There's nothing that can help me. I tried everything. And if you're new and you're in this room today, and you've exhausted every avenue of hope, if there's no place left for you to turn, if you've used up everybody, every resource, if there's no place left for you to go, that makes you an excellent candidate for sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would go to Jerry and I'd say, Jerry, I'm not smart enough to do this thing. I've never done anything like this before. I've never even read a book. And if you feel that way, Let me assure you, this deal is not dependent on individual skills or intelligence or skills that you may or may not have. This deal is for everybody. This truly is God's deal. We come in here just the way we are, what we've got, and a whole lot of what we don't have, and we do the best that we can do. And my best was just like that. But when I applied my best to the plan of recovery outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, God took this and He made this out of it. And I see Him do it over and over and over and over and over again. And I can't explain it. I don't want to explain it. All I want to do is do it. Alcoholics Anonymous will not work for people who need it. It will not work for people who want it. Alcoholics Anonymous only works for people who do it. In the second foreword book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says people come to Alcoholics Anonymous and really try. 50% get sober at once. After a few relapses, another 25%. And those that will just continue to come, their lives improve. I know a man in Orlando, he just seems like he cannot get this thing at all. But he'll have 4 months, he'll have 3 months, he'll have 6 months. But you know what? His life has improved. His life has improved. Alcoholics Anonymous can make the life of any alcoholic better just by keeping coming back. I love Wayne's talk last night. Wayne kept coming, he kept coming. Keep coming. Come drunk. Come. Keep coming. Keep coming. Jerry gave me one option. He said, do you have a desire to stop drinking? I said, yes, I have a desire to stop drinking. He said, then you'll do a fourth step. He said, if you have a desire to stop drinking, you'll do a fifth step. If you have a desire to stop drinking, you'll try to right the wrongs. And from a jail cell in Seminole County, I did the best that I could do with the process of recovery. And I'd like to tell you that when I went before the judge, I explained to him how the great things God was doing in my life and all this kind of thing. And he said, well, boy, that's just wonderful. You can go home right now. But it did not happen. When I went before the judge, he said, well, we're going to give you a little something extra to help you clean up this mess you've made. And he gave me some time. And I look back at that today, and I thank God for every day that I spent, those last 2 years I spent locked up. I needed that much time. I was absolutely nuts. I was antisocial. I had a real problem. I had a little problem with rage. And God worked on me in those 2 years and helped me. I ended up in a camp in North Florida. Going through medical and receiving there, it was 2 weeks since I'd been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, 2 weeks since I had had contact with another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as they were taking us off the bus, we were all chained together. There was a guy in there mopping the floor, and I looked at him and said, do you have AA here? Is there AA here? He said, well, yeah, I think they have a meeting tonight. I said, oh, boy, you know. And they took us into a cell block there and said, you men are all in orientation for the next 72 hours. We're going to keep you here isolated in population. Everything you do will be in here. I said, man, I want to go to that AA meeting tonight. And I watched one guy walk over to the correctional officer, and he'd say, I need to go to commissary. I need some cigarettes. And he'd say, no. Boy, and I'd watch another guy. He'd walk over there and say, I need to go to the telephone. I need to call my attorney. And he'd say, no. I said, man, I want to go to that AA meeting tonight. I put my head down. And I said, God, I'd sure like to go to that meeting tonight. I'm just going to put it in your hands. And I walked over to the correctional officer and said, I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really need to go to that meeting tonight. And he's looked at me and said, well, go ahead. And I got really active in the meeting we had there in that camp. There were always 75 or 80 guys there. I said, man, wow, Alcoholics Anonymous is popular here, boy. They had cake and coffee, and then the two outside female sponsors came in. It wasn't very long I figured out why the meetings were so popular. Just that good cake, I guess. But boy, I got active, and they would let me chair the meetings, and they would let me participate. And boy, I would get in there, and sometimes no one would share. No one would want to do anything. When that would happen, I'd just bust the book open and start reading. Boy, they didn't like that very much, but it helped me a lot, and I stayed sober. Me and some guys got together, and what we wanted was another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There were a few of us, a handful of us, that felt that AA was our option for sobriety, and that we wanted to put everything we had personally into this thing. And so we were talking about it. And, you know, I was at Tom Ice Correctional Conference, Area 51, a couple of years ago. And After 3 days of meetings and panels and sharing between meetings and talking late into the night, the two things that really became clear to me out of that whole conference was that guys that wait until they get out to try to do something about changing their lives do not make it. And I can tell you that from personal experience. The second thing was that more meetings were needed inside our facilities. And that's what we wanted. We wanted another meeting. We wanted to meet. So what we did is just asked everyone on the compound if they would be there, be responsible for that hour so that we could be together. And everyone just said, no, you know. So one of the guys said, boy, they're not going to listen to us. We're all just convicts. We're numbers. We've forgotten where we're at. No one's going to do anything for us. So one guy said, hey, let's pray about it. You know, we don't know what prayer is. We only know that it is. So we started praying about it. Father, we'd sure like to have a meeting. We're just going to put it in your hands. We prayed and prayed about it. And a couple of months later, they came to us from that department and said, you know, we've got a night. Nothing's going on. If you guys still want to have that meeting, you can have that meeting. And we said, thank you. And we said, thank you. And boy, we had our meeting. Man, I got the books. I got some chips. I picked out a good room for us. I named the meeting. I figured I'd be the chairman. I said, man, I'm going to have to ramrod this deal. These guys need me. In the first meeting, we had the meeting, and, you know, some guy said something. I said, you can't say that here. That's against tradition. He said, well, which one? I said, I don't know. It's got to be against one of them. He flew over the table on me, and I almost, you know, we fired each other up. It was a mess. It was a mess. All that next week, I just prayed and prayed. I said, God, what am I going to do? I can't just turn this meeting over to those idiots. They'll ruin it. So I waited all week long, you know. And the next week, I went to the meeting, you know, and all the guys were there. And I was standing in the doorway thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And some of the guys came over to me and said, Lee, we've talked about it. We've decided that if you'll sit right over there and be quiet, we'll let you stay. They did okay. There was nothing in my life that meant more to me at that time than those men in that hour, and that we could be together. We knew that was a meeting that came from heaven, and we appreciated it. Let me tell you what happened to me as a result of applying a program of recovery as described in the pages of our book. And trying to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous any way I could be used. On Saturday mornings, it was usually quiet on the compound. Most of the guys would sleep in. It was really the only opportunity to do that. I'd been locked up 16 or 18 months at that time. And I would use that time to go out on the compound and practice my 11th step. You know, I prayed every day. But Saturday mornings was a special time because I had some solitude. And I could really spend some time doing that, trying to establish an effect and grow in that relationship with this power greater than ourselves. And I was out on the compound, and I could feel the warmth of the sun on the side of my face, and I could feel that breeze blowing, and I could hear the little birds. And I was out there, and I was just talking to God. And I realized that I was happy. For the first time in my life, I knew that it was okay to be me, that my life was really going somewhere. I mean, I was in prison, and I felt like $1 million. And you're not supposed to feel that way in prison. You're supposed to be discouraged. You're supposed to be filled with despair. You're supposed to be lost. You're supposed to be alone. You're supposed to know that there is no hope. You're supposed to be filled with fear and filled with hate. But my roots had grasped new soil. Inside of me there was a power greater than me that was guiding my life and taking me to something better. I was not happy to be in prison, but I found happiness in the midst of prison because He was with me. Augustine wrote, Thou hast made us for Thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in Thee. Let me tell you something. God does not give us pain, suffering, or sorrow. God gives us the strength to endure it, no matter what. I got out. They suggested that the day you get out, you go straight to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I did. John picked me up. John and I got sober together. John has helped me for 15 years. He took me straight to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like I had prison written across my forehead. Little discussion meeting went around the room. It was my turn to share. I had my head down. I said, I just got out of jail. I couldn't even say prison. The guy chairing the meeting looked up and said, well, we're glad you're out of jail. And if you really mean business about doing something about your drinking, you've come to the right place. You didn't care where I'd been or what I'd done. All you cared about was what I was willing to do about my recovery and how you could help me. And that's all I've ever found in Alcoholics Anonymous, was people that wanted to help me no matter what. I've never been asked to leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never been told I was too bad that I couldn't make it here. I've always heard, Lee, if you'll do it, it'll work for you. If you put forth the action necessary, it'll work for you. And if you don't drink today, you'll never have to take another drink, because it's always today. And if you don't drink, you can't get drunk. Everybody got around me and tried to teach and introduce this program to me. I went to 110 meetings my first 90 days out. 100 the next 90 and 90 the next 90, and I just lived in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I rode the bicycle to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. People would come by and pick me up and take me to meetings, take me into their homes and feed me. A man had two coats, and he gave me a coat. Of course, you know what I did. I caused trouble immediately. I was only out a couple of weeks. And we were closing the meeting one night, and I felt some little tiny hand slip itself into mine, and whoa! Something I had not felt in a while came over me. Now, everybody knows that you're supposed to go to the Golden Lamb for coffee after the meeting. Well, this night, this woman and I, we went someplace else. I was so dumb that I did not realize that just anything could happen if a man and a woman went off together alone. And it was that night that anything happened. And so the next day I got up, man, I felt great. I couldn't wait to get to the meeting. You know, I went to work, got off work, raced down there. They started the meeting. I just got there at the end of the serenity prayer. When there were 30 people around two big tables, I raised my head up and looked way down at the other end. There was that woman. I said, oh, there she is, you know. And then she was crying. I said, she's crying. Something must have happened. She's upset. I was just with her last night. Everything was great. You know? I wonder what could have happened. They said, does anyone have anything to share? And she goes, oh, I feel like I've been used. I said, oh, shit. She said, I feel like I've been used by him. They're going to throw me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. What am I going to do? I'm never going to get to come back. And there was a little old-timer there by the name of Elise that turned to her and said, honey, if you don't like the way it feels, don't ever do it again. Probably saved my life. John came up to me after the meeting and said, Lee, how'd that feel? I said, boy, that didn't feel very good at all. He said, guess what? If you don't ever do that again, you'll never have to feel that way again. I wish I'd gotten that lesson the first time. Elise came up to me, handed me the keys, and said, next week you open up. I guess she thought maybe I might need a little something to do other than what I was doing. And boy, they know when they've got you too, you know. And so, of course, I took those keys. And boy, I was scared to death. I said, oh my God, I've got to get there early. I've got to straighten the chairs. I've got to lay out some literature. I've got to make the coffee, you know. And boy, I showed up. I just did the best that I could do. And it went okay. And man, I just felt like I was Mr. AA, you know. And I just did that week after week after week. You know what? When they give you these jobs and you do pretty good, guess what? They'll give you other jobs and other jobs and other jobs. That's been my experience in service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard Betty S., a Texan, a lady that passed on a couple of years ago, share down in West Palm Beach a poem that really just sums up my service career. My child helped me snip beans today. She kept the bad and threw the good away. I think how patient God must be when I help him the way she helps me. I've stayed sober, and I've always had a job in Alcoholics Anonymous. They suggested a sponsor. I looked around the room. It looked like the popular thing to do. I certainly wanted to be popular. So I asked this fellow named Butch. Don't ever ask anybody named Butch. I thought he ought to loan me a little money. He told me to shut up. He said I was stupid. He said, get in there and go down and sit on the front row. That's where the stupid people sit. No offense. Another time I went to Butch. I said, Butch, I had some resentments. I said, I wrote them all down. I went to Butch. I said, Butch, I've done a lot of work here. I want to show it to you. I went down this list. I don't like this. I don't like this. I don't like this. And I don't like this. And this sucks. And this stinks. And what about that? And look at this guy. He said, boy, you don't sound very happy with what you have here. Maybe you ought to just go get drunk. See how you like that. I said, well, I don't want to get drunk. He said, you're not very happy. So I got happy. I said, maybe this stuff isn't as bad as I thought. And gratitude certainly is the hinge on which the gate of sobriety swings. I've never seen a grateful alcoholic get drunk. And never have I ever seen a person fail that thoroughly followed this path. And boy, what a path do we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You could never have explained to me what I was going to find when I came in here to be with you. I didn't know if I wanted what you had. I just knew I didn't want what I had. September the 12th, 1986, I was released from penitentiary for what I know can be the last time. March 30, 1992, Division of Parole and Pardons released me off paper 15 and a half years early. That's after having spent 17 and a half years of my life in the correction system, inside or on some kind of paper, waiting to go back, knowing I was going to go back, knowing that was going to be my life. And I brought nothing here with me. Could have helped me do anything other than what I'd done in the past. I came here with a shoebox. That's what I brought with me when I came to you. I came here with a shoebox with some letters and some pencils, one change of socks and one change of underwear. But everything in life that I needed to have a different life, to be a different person. You know, we read the book for information. We do that book for transformation. That has happened to me because of you and this program. I had 11 jobs the first 18 months that I was out. I wasn't any better at that sober than I was drunk. Every job I had one thing really, really wrong with it, you know. They wanted me to work. Man, I just couldn't. I couldn't get it together. And I was going into jail one night, and guy was coming out of the jail, and I spoke with him, and he goes, you know, you could work where I work. You could do what I do. And handed me the guy's phone number and said, call him tomorrow. You know, you could, this will be okay. I'll put in a good word for you. I said, good, good. So later that night, I went to my regular meeting. And I told everybody there, showed them that card. Look at this. Maybe I'll get this job, you know. And they said, get a job. So the next day I called this guy. And he said, yes, come down here tomorrow. We need some people immediately. Bring your resume. Click. I said, resume? What am I going to put on some kind of resume? I can't do this. Bad deal, bad deal. You know, state prison, state prison, state prison. You know? Boy, bad deal. So I went to the meeting that night. And these guys said, did you call that fellow? I said, yes, I called him. Big mistake I almost made. They wanted a resume. And they said, well, we think you ought to go down there. We think you ought to go down there and tell that man the truth. I said, well, I can't do that, you know. And they put it to me like this. We don't even want to see you if you're not willing to go down there. I said, man. So when I got home, boy, I prayed about that. I said, God, you got to help me. You know, I can't go down there. What am I going to tell that guy? I can't. You're going to have to go with me. You go with me. We'll go down there. So the next day I got up, 10 o'clock, I was in that man's office. I said, we're not going to be here very long. He told me, sit down over there. I sat down. He goes, where's your resume? I said, I don't have a resume. He said, well, no big deal. Do you have any experience in sales? And the moment he said that, it's like a light went off in my mind. I said, well, yeah. I've sold microwaves and appliances and stereos and guns and boats and boats and cars and jewelry. He goes, wow, you've got a lot of experience. Think I'd get you to start tomorrow? I said, yeah, man. I sold that man's product like popcorn. I didn't have to sneak down the alley with it or keep it covered up with a blanket or hide it in the trunk of my car. You can just walk up to anybody, you know. And I don't think God minds it at all that we have a little something and do pretty good here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I take God with me everywhere I go today. I'd rather walk in the dark with God than walk alone in the light. It is better to walk with God by faith than to walk alone by sight. Listen to this. I become a regular guy. I have a job. I have a car. I live somewhere. I have clothes. I went back to school. I was down in intergroup office one day, and they said, "You want to be on the service committee?" I volunteered for the service committee. Man, I was on, after a year on the service committee, I said, "Wow, you know, I just felt like I was the president of AA, you know." I said, "This is important. I must be important. This is valuable. I have value." I felt so good about myself. I think I'll go back to school. And I went back to school and got an education. Sometimes I have a girlfriend. Sometimes I have serenity. You don't always get both of those, you know. I was really perplexed about this. I asked an old timer once if he thought sex was dirty. He said, "Only if you're doing it right." I said, "Well, thanks for clearing that up." I want to tell you about my work. You know, I was grateful to have a job, and I was grateful to have tires and have an income and be able to take care of myself. But I didn't particularly like what I did for a living. I didn't like the people I was around. They didn't care anything about sobriety at all. And they certainly didn't care anything about God. And I said, "God, you know, these people know what I'm about, and they don't seem very interested at all. Is this really where you want me?" And I started praying about it. And I said, "God, what's my niche? Aren't I good at anything? Isn't there anything I'd like doing that might be something interesting or even helpful to someone else?" I heard a lady in a meeting say once, she goes, "I woke up at 4 o'clock this morning, and I love what I do so much that I just laid there. I couldn't go back to sleep. I was so excited about getting up and going to work." I said, "My God, I don't feel that way at all. I hate what I do." But I started praying about that. I said, "God, what's my niche? I mean, isn't there anything for me?" And early in my sobriety, I heard a guy say once, "Lee, if you'll take care of God's business, he'll take care of your business." And I said, "God, I don't know what to do other than just keep sponsoring these guys and just keep taking every job in AA I can take and just stay as busy in AA as I can." And it is my experience, if you take care of God's business, that he'll give you a business. Because that's what he did for me. And I love what I do today. I'll tell you this, sometimes I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm so excited about getting up and getting to go do what I do for a living that I just cannot go back to sleep. And that last month that I worked solidly, I loved every minute of it. I got tired, but I loved every minute of it. And that is a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous blessing. I'm going to close. I'd like to tell you a couple of my amends briefly. And the guys I sponsor and work with, it's very common that there's several areas of this program that the new people have problems with that I work with. One's the God thing. We have a lot of trouble with God. I like what Dr. Bob said. I think that really sums it up for me. If you are an atheist or an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which might prevent you from having what's offered to you in this book, I feel sorry for you. I mean, it's a pretty easy thing when you can come up with your own conception. Whatever you want to believe. You know, you can't have it your way in any area of the program but that one. In that one area, anything's okay. And as long as you believe something or are willing to. Another area of the guys I work with, it's usually around the fourth and fifth steps. Particularly the fifth step. It's a tough thing to really just lay it all out there. You know, my first efforts at a fourth and fifth, I did in a jail cell. They said it was a bad idea to do that. But man, I wanted sobriety. And, you know, I don't know how well or how effective I was at identifying exact natures, but I got all the secrets out. And if a new person can accomplish that, just get all those secrets out, man, you've come a long way. And it's what a relief, what a wonderful thing to be one person, to not be an inside person and an outside person, to stand before someone else in God and be, for the first time in your life, one whole person. What you see is what you get. Tremendously powerful spiritual thing. I was having a lot of difficulty with the ninth step. And my sponsor didn't let me lay around very long at all. He said, Lee, you'll never overcome alcoholism until you've done all you can do to clean up the mess you've made of your life. And we got together and we made a list. And I looked at that list. I said, my God, how am I ever going to repay whole communities or cities, you know, for all the harm I've caused them? Well, I just felt overwhelmed. One day I grabbed the bull by the horns and I went out just to try to do the best I could at cleaning up my life. And I had several things on that list. I said, what do you do? My father was dead. How could I go to my father and try to clean up the mess with him? My father had been killed. But I did, like the book said, I wrote a letter, an honest letter, and I went to my father's grave and I read that letter. And when I'm in Arkansas, I visit my father's grave. And when I'm there, I sit and I talk with my father, just as if he was right in front of me. And, you know, at one time I didn't have good thoughts about my father. But as a result of doing that and continuing to do it, you know, when I think of my father today, I have wonderful thoughts about my father. You know, I remember when I was a small child that my father, I remember him getting down on his knees next to my bed with me and trying to teach me how to pray. You know, when I think of that, and I said, wow, I had a great father. I had a great father that he would do that with me. Another area was I'd committed a lot of crimes. And I said, what am I going to do about this? All these crimes I've committed. And my sponsor referred me to a man that had been sober a long, long, long time. At that time, over 40 years sober, Charlie L., who passed on a couple of years ago with 52 years of sobriety. And I went to Charlie and I laid it out to Charlie, and Charlie said, Lee, I don't think you need to go back to prison, because the book refers to an example of maybe we might go to jail if we do some of this stuff. We have to be willing to do that. Charlie said, I don't think you need to, Lee. I think that in this case you might find another way to clean this mess up. So I prayed about that, and I was in the meeting once, and I noticed the board, and there was a guy's name on the board, and it said, need ride to meeting, so-and-so. So I said, well, I'm going to start taking this guy to meetings. So I went and I would pick up Saul and take him to meetings. Now Saul, on his last drunk, he lost both his legs. That's what happened to him the last time he took a drink. And I would go and, you know, you pick Saul up, you put him in the front seat, you wrap up the wheelchair, you put it in the trunk, and then you go to the meeting, and then you do that in reverse. And when I first started doing that, I said, this is very difficult. I don't know if I can do this. But after only a month, that was like the richest part of my life. I couldn't wait to get over there and get that guy and get him to the meetings. After 9 months, we're all fighting over who goes and picks up Saul. You know? We take him in his meetings. They'd read that third chapter. We are like men who have lost our legs. All the new people would lean over and look at Saul. You know, he'd say the same thing every week. This is what happened to me the last time I took a drink. And what a powerful, powerful, powerful message that guy had. And there's no telling how many people he saved with it. I had harmed my family tremendously. I have a very, very, very huge, I have a huge family. And my grandparents never turned their back on me. They always did everything they could ever do to try to save me or help me. But the rest of my family had watched me hurt these people that loved me more than anything else in life over and over and over and over again. And they were very reluctant to have anything to do with me. And I do not blame them. But I, after I was out a year, I flew to Arkansas to visit my grandparents. And what I would do is I'd fly in on a Friday. Saturday I would go around and make some amends. You know, people give us these jobs and we steal from them, or we destroy these places we live. And I was trying to clean up some of this stuff. That night I'd also visit my older relatives that couldn't get out, and I have a handicapped cousin, and I'd visit him. Saturday night I'd go to a meeting. I'd spend all day with my grandparents and give them all day. I'd been doing this for 3 or 4 years, flying to Arkansas once or twice a year, and continuing this. And after about 3 years, one of my uncles would come by, or one of my aunts would call. When I was 10 years sober, I'd been coming to Arkansas for 7 years. And I flew in on a Friday. Saturday, I visited my older relatives that couldn't get out, my handicapped cousin. Went to a meeting Saturday night. Sunday morning, 40 members of my family came over to my grandparents' house just to be with me. One of my uncles came over to me and said, Lee, there's just something about you that makes people want to be together. And I thought to myself, I know what it is. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. I really appreciate what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. I cannot fit AA into my life. AA is my life. I've said that sometimes, and people come to me and say, well, boy, it's not my life. I came here so I could have a life. Good for you. But that's not what I want. I want this, and I want more of this. And I want to do more in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to be more here. And I want to go anywhere Alcoholics Anonymous can take me. I'm going to close with a story. It's a story that means a lot to me, and it's my idea of what a higher power is today. You know, when Bill, in Bill's story, his higher power, he said he'd found a new friend. And that's where Bill started. And that's a good place to start. But by the time Bill got to the fifth chapter, his higher power had grown and changed. And he said his higher power was a director. It was an employer. It was a principal. And Bill said that his higher power was certainly a father. This is a true story. It happened in 1989. It was in Armenia. That a father walked his son to school. And after walking his son to the steps of the school, he walked several blocks to where he was working. And that day in Armenia, they had an earthquake. And that city was absolutely destroyed. And they do not build buildings in Armenia the way they build them out there in California where Wayne lives. They build them out of rock and stone and brick. And that city was just flattened. And that father miraculously drug himself out of the rubble of that building and ran those blocks where that school had been. Past fires, people screaming, emergency vehicles. When he got to the school, it was just a pile of stone. And he ran to the top of the pile and started throwing rocks and throwing bricks and screaming out his son's name, Armand, Armand, Armand. And people would come to him and they'd say, you're cut, let us bandage you. You're in shock, let us help you. And he'd say, no, help me find my son, help me find my son. And they'd say, he's delirious, and they would go off and try to help someone else. 36 hours later, he was still there screaming out his son's name and throwing rocks and throwing bricks. After 36 hours, he heard something. He said, Armand, is it you? He heard, yes, Father, it's me. He said, son, are you all right? He said, yes, Father, I'm all right. There are 13 of us in here. I told them that if my father is alive, he will not rest until he saves me. And when he's helped me, he'll help you too. You new people? Here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a father. In the fifth chapter, Bill wrote, he is the father, we are his children. In the closing of Dr. Bob's story, Dr. Bob wrote, your heavenly father will never let you down. Here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you have a heavenly spiritual father who will not rest until he saves you. He will not rest until he reaches you. And after he's helped you, he's going to use you to help somebody else. I love everybody here, and thank you very much for this weekend. Thank you for helping me stay safe today.